I want to greet you this morning in Jesus' name, the one who Paul writes to the Colossians. He says this way, who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature, for by him were all things created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible, whether there be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created by him and for him, and he is before all things, and by him all things consist, and he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might have the preeminence. For it pleased the Father that in him should all fullness dwell. It's been a blessing to be here this morning to think about what Paul wrote to the Philippians in the devotional, in the Sunday school, thinking of the passage in Revelations 20, where we're still not quite sure how we want to deal with all of these things, and that's good, and that's all right. But I had to think of this passage in light of that, where Jesus Christ will become someday. We recognize him now as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now it says not everything is put under his feet yet, but sometime things are going to be so. They're all going to be settled. Things are going to be all shaken out, and everything's going to be put in its place. And it's because of Jesus Christ and because of who he is. Until that time, we want to recognize him as our head, as our leader. He is the head of the body and of the church. So it's been a blessing to be here this morning. I have a sermon this morning I'd like to preach. Now, I know I have this habit of preaching sermons that are maybe a little bit out there sometimes and a little bit perhaps more doctrinal. And this is kind of what I like to preach about. But this morning I'd like to preach a sermon that's probably pretty practical, at least for people my age, parents with families, things like that. A couple things I'd like to say before we start. And that is, I plan to preach to us as fathers and to you as mothers. So as young people, please don't take this sermon as leverage against your parents. They're not perfect people, but you have to remember that you're not either, all right? The other thing that you can think about when you're listening to this sermon, and I hope you listen to it, is because you just might be a parent sometime, and there's a good chance that time is going to come a lot sooner than you think. It's just how life goes. I know that when you're 18, the possibility of being a father is just, it's remote. It seems remote. But it seems the more decades that you have in back of you, the faster they come at you. At least that's sort of what I'm experiencing. So by the time you're 28, you just might be a father. And so you can remember this sermon maybe. I don't know if you remember by then or not. The other thing is that many of you are looking back at the time that you had the children around your table and children sitting on your lap. And please understand that I'm not trying to be critical of you or trying to tell you how that you should have done it. That's not the point of the sermon. I just want to say that the story of my family and the story of the families that are still gathered all around your parents' table, I want to say those stories have not been, they have barely begun. But I also want to say that the stories of the families that are dispersed and your empty nesters, I want to say that story is not all written yet either. So may God give us grace together. I know that there is one thing that we all have in common, whether we are looking ahead to that time or whether we are in the middle of it or whether we are looking back to the time that we had our children around us, and that is that we all need the grace of God. I would like for you to think of a phrase that's found many times in the scripture, and that's the phrase, my son. We read it many times in Proverbs, my son, hear the instruction of thy father and forsake not the law of thy mother. He says, my son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. My son, walk not thou in the way with them. Refrain thy foot from their path. My son, forget not my law, but let thine heart keep my commandment. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, neither be weary of his correction. He says, hear, O my son, and receive my sayings, and the years of thy life shall be many. So on. Proverbs 23, verse 26, my son, give me your heart, and let thine eyes observe my ways. I want you to keep that verse in mind. My son, give me thine heart, and let thine eyes observe my ways. Another verse, my son, be wise and make my heart glad that I may answer him that reproacheth me. Do you see the defense that a wise son gives to his father to those who would be his enemies? And he'll say, look, here's my son. I want you to deal with him. Proverbs 31, this is the king's mother, said, what, my son, and what the son of my womb, and what the son of my vows? Do you see the personal belonging that my son has in the Godhead, the Father to the Son? Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. God said, when Jesus was baptized, this is my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. In Luke 15, the parable of the lost son, the father says, this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Paul to Timothy says, thou therefore, my son. In 3 John verse 4, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. Now, I don't know if you ever hear this or not, but this is something that I don't like to hear, and I try not to say it. It's for a husband to refer to his wife as the wife, he just refers to his wife as her. It's kind of impersonal, but all you have to do is change that the wife to my wife, and it changes the whole perspective, because speaks of relationship. Now, my wife and I, sometimes when we're too lazy to take care of a need that one of our children have, we'll just refer to the issue as your child has a problem over here. We say that tongue in cheek, but when it becomes my child, it becomes something that's pertinent to us. My son, my daughter, my child. It speaks of personal relationship. It speaks of personal responsibility. It speaks of personal possession. They are yours. It speaks of a responsibility of personal care. My son, my child, my daughter. Of all of the psalmist David's moving words, perhaps the most emotion-packed was his expression of grief when he heard of Absalom's death. This is recorded for us in 2 Samuel 18. And the king was much moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, thus he said, oh, my son, Absalom, my son, Absalom. Would to God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son. You see the intensity with which he felt Absalom being his own. He took personal responsibility. He took a personal possession of Absalom as his son. He had a personal care for him. Then we have that beautiful passage in Genesis 22 where God was going to test Abraham, and he told him to go sacrifice Isaac, his only begotten, his only promised son, and offer him on an altar at the place where he was going to show him. And they were on their way up across there, and they had left their servants back with the donkeys and so on. And they were moving on up the mountain. And Isaac spake unto Abraham his father and said, my father. And he said, here am I, my son. And he said, behold the fire and the wood. But where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, my son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they both went of them So they went, both of them together. What I want to suggest to you is that if we want our children to regard us as my father or as my mother, as my parent, as Isaac did, I think we must first have them, we must first have claimed them as my son or my daughter. And I think that was Abraham's relationship to Isaac. I think us as parents need to go first in that. Now in Malachi chapter 4, verse 5, there's these few verses right at the end of Malachi, at the end of the Old Testament. Behold, I will send before you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Now, when he was prophesying about Elijah the prophet coming, I believe he was talking about John the Baptist coming and preparing the way for Jesus to come. And one of the things that John the Baptist was going to do was he was going to turn the hearts of the father to the children and the children, the hearts of the children to the fathers. And I think the perhaps the sequence is notable here, and this is what I'm trying to tell you, is that if you want the heart of your children to be turned to you as a parent, you must first have given your heart to them. I believe it's the father's responsibility. I think it's the mother's, the parent's responsibility to go first. And then your children will have a much easier and a much better time of turning their heart to you. Now, there's a passage in, I was going to look this up. Husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them. And we sometimes refer to this at a wedding, and we just can hardly understand as we're sitting here in front of the church as newlyweds or as just getting married, how that ever something like that would even have to be spoken in Scripture, that you're not supposed to be bitter against your wife. But the Scriptures, God in the Scriptures, God in inspiring the Scriptures knows what he was doing, and he knew the tendencies we have in our heart as husbands that we can become bitter against our wives. Now, when you're first introduced to that little red-faced, puffy-eyed little life, your life is forever changed. Your heart is stirred like it never was before. And you would say, however could I have to be instructed that I have to give my heart to this little individual? But yet, we know the reality. Just like husbands should recognize the reality of that bitterness being, that we are capable of bitterness towards our wives. Us as parents are capable of turning our hearts away from that little person that we have just been given. Sometimes we become resentful of the changes they bring. They are actually quite demanding. They cost us plans. The things that we want to do suddenly are all rearranged. In the spectrum of my life so far, what changed our life, what changed my life more than anything else, besides my decision to follow Christ, but even more so than becoming married, was having our first child. They just change your life. Your world is rocked. Suddenly things aren't just not simply like they were anymore. And the plans and the ideals that you might have had will probably be just gone in a puff in the first whale. They just do that to you. But they cost us our plans. They cost us money. They cost us energy. They cost us sleep. Sometimes they even cost us our dignity. And we are tempted to turn our hearts. We are tempted to become resentful. But we have to remember these children that God has given us are his heritage, and they are his reward. Psalms 127, verses 3 to 5. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of the mighty man, so are the children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. What was that verse that I had looked at in Proverbs? My son, be wise and make my heart glad, that I may answer him that reproacheth me. All right, David says they're going to speak with the enemies at the gate. Somehow, children around a father, children around parents, surrounding parents, validate the parents' ministry and the parents' efforts and the parents' work in the kingdom of God. I think that's what that's saying. They shall speak with the enemies in the gate. But they are our heritage, and they are a reward. So we must claim them as our responsibility. They are ours to care for. They are ours to instruct and to discipline. They are ours to relate to them. Not for our sakes, but so that the kingdom of God can grow. But what I want us to understand as we get into this is that the attitude of my child, of it being a personal responsibility, is something that I want to have a groundwork as we go into this sermon. So I have here 10 things that children need. And I just made this list up. And it's not a comprehensive list. It's by no means, probably not even very well thought through. But I offer these to you as a means of instruction and encouragement. So I give you these things that I thought of that children need. And the first is time. Now, there's this thing about quality time. And I'd like to just give you a comment about that, Not to say that the time that we spend together shouldn't be worthwhile, but I don't think that we can redeem the lack of time that we spend with our children by trying to make up for it and in being a special time or a quality time, by doing something extra special. Not to say that we shouldn't spend special times together, but I don't think it can take the place of a day in and day out kind of rubbing shoulders, a kind of relationship. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 6 to 9. And this gives us the picture of how that we are to instruct and teach and relate to our children. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. And thou shalt write them upon the post of thine house and on thy gates. So it's not some kind of a special time that we're spending together with our children, but it's all the time that we spend together with our children. And it's when these things are a sign on our hand, they are frontlets between our eyes. The law of God becomes how we see things, and it becomes the motivation for the things that we do. And these things will come out of our lives and influence the lives of our children. And we will teach them to our children all the time, not just some kind of a special quality time. The idea is that the law of God must be first a part of your very being, and then out of that, these principles that you taught, that you are teaching, just flow out of who you are. Yes, it is intentional, but it is not sporadic, and it's not only given on special occasions, but rather our teachings and our relating to them are on a constant flow, not just relegated to quality time or special times. All right, the second thing I have is that children need to hear us say yes. They need to hear that we approve of them. They need affirmation. They need praise. Now, this is probably 20 years ago or so. My uncles had a little foster boy named Johnny. And as a lot of those situations are, coming from not ideal homes, this was his situation as well. But he was there with my uncle's place, and we were there visiting one Sunday afternoon. And they told him to go close the screen door or close the back kitchen door, whatever it was, I don't remember, but it was either to open or close a door. And they just went and told him to do that. And this guy was just about 2 years old or could hardly even walk. I don't remember how old he was. He was just a little tyke. And he toddled over there and closed the door. And they praised him for that and said, "Thank you, Johnny, that was good." And this little guy just about couldn't contain the joy. He just kind of did this little dance and just had this beaming response on his face just simply because of the affirmation that they gave to him. I don't think he'd ever heard something like that before. They need that. Our children need affirmation to know that you approve of them. Training is a yes. Training is us hearing, is us saying yes. It is showing how something should be done. It is practicing together. It is a demonstration. It is working alongside of. These things are how we say yes to our children. It says in Ephesians, "And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." So what he's saying is don't place unreasonable demands on them that frustrate them. But it says to bring them up. And to bring, when you bring something, it means that you are in that place already. You can't bring something if you're not there. So when you are supposed to bring them up, when we're supposed to bring up our children, it means that we're bringing our children along. Nurture and admonition speaks of a thorough and perhaps even a systematic training and discipline. So we bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. This is the yes part of it. Our children need to hear us say yes, but they also need to hear us say no. 1 Kings 1 tells the story of how Adonijah, who was one of David's sons, wanted to be king. But it also says that David had never at any time displeased him at any time in saying, "Why hast thou done so?" So what David did with Adonijah was he had never stood in his way. He had never called him on the carpet. He had never said, "Adonijah, listen here, what's this all about? Adonijah, no, you can't do this." So in other words, Adonijah was a spoiled kid. David had never stood in his way. Now, for some reason or the other, David had in mind for Solomon to be king rather than Adonijah. And Adonijah was the oldest living son. And so, of course, Adonijah, as David was old, he proclaimed himself king. But when David heard of it, Nathan and Bathsheba came to David and said, "Look, I thought you wanted Solomon to be king." And David said, "Yes." And so he sent Nathan the prophet to anoint Solomon the king. And when Adonijah heard it, he fled to the temple and grabbed hold of the horns of the altar. I guess that was a place of sanctuary, it was a place of refuge. Because as it goes in kingly courts of the ancient times, Adonijah's life was in danger because he himself had sought to be king. But Solomon said, "All right, if you prove yourself to be worthy, I will allow you to be lived. I will allow you to live." But things didn't turn out well for Adonijah when he wanted some of the king's rights, who was this girl that had comforted David. If you want to read about the story in the beginning of 1 Kings 1, she had comforted David as he was an old man. And Adonijah wanted this girl for his wife. But somehow Solomon said, "No, you can't have her." And Solomon took this as Adonijah wanting part of the king's rights, and he had Adonijah killed. So Adonijah was always used to having his own way, and when perhaps for the first time he couldn't, he tried to have his own way anyway, and it cost him his life. When we first had children, my wife asked a mother of a large, seemingly well-functioning home for her advice, and this mother's advice to my wife was, never stop saying no. I think that's good advice. Never stop saying no. See, discipline is the negative side of the training coin. It's inflicting pain or placing restrictions as a means of reinforcing training. It's how we say no. And we always have to say no. So the third thing is that our children need to hear us say no. The fourth thing I thought of is that our children need responsibility. Now, much of the self-esteem that's deemed so important by the world, I'm going to suggest to you, becomes meaningless and dull compared to what the satisfaction that a child gets from having a job well done. And I'm not saying that an individual's worth is determined I'm not saying that a child's worth is determined by what the child can do, by what he can accomplish. We reduce the person to a machine when we value them by what they can do. This child is precious as a person because he was created in the image of God. However, I think we can say that a person's satisfaction with his lot in life is directly connected to his service to his fellow man. A person's satisfaction with his lot in life is directly connected to his service to his fellow man. And so we need to teach our children responsibility. It is in giving, St. Francis of Assisi said, it is in giving that we receive. And our children need to learn that. So we need to give them meaningful chores and meaningful jobs. To be sure, the most meaningful chore becomes mundane, and we need to teach them to be self-disciplined and self-motivated. They need to learn that to do the job, even if they don't feel like it. But I also think that a job that is given to a child simply by means of keeping them out from underfoot, to get them out of your way, will soon be perceived as just that. We need to give them meaningful chores and meaningful jobs, and we need to give them at least a meaningful compensation for it, whether it's just a word of affirmation or whether it's a tip from grandma when her grandchildren come to help her. If the only reason that we are giving our children chores is to keep them out from underfoot, is we are telling them that they're not worth more than that. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, in his poem The Village Blacksmith, says his brow is wet with an honest sweat, and he earns whate'er he can. He looks the whole world in the face, for he owes not any man. A child needs to learn the value of honest sweat, of the satisfaction of a job well done. The meaningless and vapid self-esteem that's promoted by the world is displaced by knowing that they have served. It is in giving that we receive. All right, number five. Children need their parents to love them. Now, yesterday, in the Beside the Still Waters article, a man by the name of Don Reed wrote, typically, children have a desire to emulate those who are closest to them, especially those who fulfill their need of love. Did you get that? Typically, children have a desire to emulate those who are closest to them, especially those who fulfill their need of love. If this man is right, and I think he is, perhaps this is the best antidote to peer pressure that we can ever give our children. Our children need to feel loved and accepted by us. Isaiah asks the question, or God asks the question in Isaiah, just kind of a rhetorical question. Can a woman forget her sucking child that she should not have compassion on the son of her womb? He's saying, of course not. But he said, even if she forgets, I won't forget you. But can a woman forget her sucking child? No, she can't. A woman, a parent, needs to love their children. And they need to feel loved and accepted by us. Now, Jacob loved Joseph. We looked at this last Sunday. Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. Now, we believe that God worked in spite of the situation. That's a miracle of the sovereignty of God. But we see a family that was rocked by jealousy because Jacob loved Joseph more than his other sons. And I think the reason is that he was the son. He was the eldest son of his favorite wife. So with two wives and two concubines and 12 sons by these four women, it's no wonder there were problems. But children need to be loved, and they need to be all loved alike. Another thing is children need their parents to love each other. Children need their parents to be together on issues. In Genesis 25, we are told how Isaac loved Esau because he liked the venison that Isaac would go out and kill and bring back, and he would fix it for him, and Isaac would eat this. And Esau loved Isaac because Isaac loved Esau because of this. But Rebekah loved Jacob. Children should never be caught in the middle between two parents. The family will be torn apart, and each child will be torn, as it is not meant to have to choose between a father and a mother. One of the scourges, I believe, in American society today is this idea of no-fault divorce. Now, there was divorce all along. But in 1969, now let me just inject this. I think the last time I preached was I preached about how we should keep church and state separate. And I tried to give you some practical and even pertinent issues today, but here's another one. In 1969, Ronald Reagan, who today is almost the godfather of the conservative political party in this country, in 1969, he legalized in California the idea, the thing that you could, he legalized no-fault divorce. And since that, every state in the union has done it as well. Before that, you had to have a good evidence. You had to have a reason to, a reason of adultery, a reason of abuse or something like that before you could divorce. But now, suddenly, you can divorce for no reason at all except that you're not compatible. And that is a state, most states will recognize that as a reason for divorce, incompatibility. All right? So if you want another reason not to endorse even a conservative political party, here it is. But anyway, children, I think that if we look back, we can see that it's because of the fatherlessness and of families being torn apart by divorce and infidelity that we have the huge social problem today of the gay rights agenda. I think the one prefaced the other. Children need the nurture provided by their mother. They need the challenges provided by their father. There are things that parents, that fathers bring into the marriage that that a mother can't. There's just things like that, and the child needs both and should never, ever have to be torn to decide between the two. They need the strength of their father. They need the sensitivity of their mother. God knew what he was doing when he designed the family as he did. And we cannot tamper with that but to our hurt. All right, the next thing that I have is children need to be able to respect their parents. If we want our children to respect us, we first of all have to be respectable. So one of our children's needs is that we ourselves are respectable. We will have to be good examples. The disconcerting thing about being a parent is this, that our children get to know us. Their perception cuts right through our Sunday clothes, and it cuts right through the things that we teach and say, right into what we are inside. And if what we are inside is not what we profess or what we appear to be, we are hypocrites, and they have little reason to respect us, and we have no right to expect to be respected. Now, there's a story in the Old Testament about Eli and his sons. And I have to give Christ either the credit or the blame for this point. I was telling him that what I want to preach, and he pointed this out to me, and I appreciated it. He pointed out Eli and his sons. The old priest Eli in the Old Testament had two sons that served in the priestly role, Hophni and Phinehas. And these men are described as sons of Belial. They were sons of perdition. They were wicked. They were worthless men bent on destruction. They would demand the best of the offerings that were brought. And if worshipers hesitated, they would take it by force. They would sleep with the women that came to the tabernacle. And Eli said this to them. He said, Why do ye such things? For I hear of your evil dealings by all these people. Nay, my sons, for it is no good report that I hear. Ye make the Lord's people to transgress. If one man sin against another, the judge shall judge him. But if a man sin against the Lord, who shall entreat for him? Notwithstanding, they hearken not unto the voice of their father, because the Lord would slay them. Why did Eli's sons not respect their father? Now, we see the sovereignty of God. It says, because the Lord would slay them. We see the sovereignty of God working here, but in a more practical sense. Why did Eli's sons not respect their father? And I'm going to submit to you that it's perhaps because their father wasn't respectable. I don't know if you ever thought of priest Eli that way before or not, but he wasn't disciplined himself. When he heard the news of how his sons were killed in battle with the Philistines and how that the Ark of the Covenant was taken, he was seated on a chair and he fell over backwards and broke his neck and died when he heard that news. But it says he was a heavy man. So he wasn't disciplined himself. So how could he effectively communicate to his sons that they need to discipline themselves? So perhaps he had been guilty of doing the very same things that his sons were doing. So we need to be respectable. If we want our children to respect us, we need to be respectable. All right, the eighth thing is children need someone that they can believe. Now, I don't know if you've ever given much thought to how the culture we live in, the culture that surrounds us, affects us. I know we're spared from a lot of that, but there are some things that we just sent that there are some things in the culture around us that shape the times that we live in, and we cannot escape it. See, there's no modern playwright who expresses himself like Shakespeare did. There is no young person today who can feel or who can relate to the angst of the Vietnam era. There's no old person who has ever been shaped by technology the way that young people have been shaped. It's just how it is. It's just how life goes. But a hallmark of the people that are of young people today, and they're called the millennial generation. I don't know if you ever heard that term or not, but they're called the millennials. I'm a Gen Xer, all right? It's just the terminology. My dad is a baby boomer, and before that there was the greatest generation. These are just pegs that we put on groups of people. So the people that are young people today are millennials. And one of the hallmarks of the millennial generation is a skepticism that is born from a constant exposure to media that promises things that it never fulfills. It is shaped by people and friends that present themselves in ways on social media that ring untrue in the real world. So they tend to be self-focused. They take selfies. Did you ever hear that term? Did you ever take a selfie? And the millennials often have a sense of entitlement. They tend to be narcissistic, which means self-focused. They tend to have a short attention span. These are all results of the technology that surrounds us. This is the world that our children are growing up in. And we do ourselves and them no favors in denying this reality. We have to deal with it. What I want to say is that in a world that is marked by skepticism and where things that seem so real are only manufactured by technology, children need someone they can trust. Children need someone that they can believe. And they need that from you. They need to be able to trust you. You have to have a personal, unflinching dedication to the truth. You have to have a personal, unflinching integrity. You need to be master over your own passions. You need to have the Spirit of God ruling in your life. And then they need you to point them to the one that they can trust so that they themselves come to trust their lives and their future and their eternity to Him who is the unfailing God. So that they can say with Paul, I know whom I have believed and am persuaded that He is able to keep that which I have committed unto Him against that day. Our children need that from us. They need someone that they can believe. And then children need their parents to be honest. They need us to be honest enough to admit our failures. They need us to be honest enough to admit our weaknesses. If you want God to work in your children, you must first allow Him to work in you. There are times when I need to apologize to my children for something I did wrong. That's just how it is. But they need that honesty and they deserve that honesty. See, if a parent is to recognize and deal with the old nature in his children, he also has to recognize and deal with it in himself. This has to do with who you are. The best program in the world cannot make up for a parent that hasn't dealt with the sinfulness in his own heart. This is my wife asking another lady, this was years ago too, some years ago, for advice in child rearing. And this lady just said, oh my, I don't know. Most of it has to do with who you are. I think she's right. You can take these points that I pointed out, but if you are not so, what's it all about? How can you transmit this if you yourself are not? It has to do with being. And that leads us to the last point that I have, is that children need a good example of all these ideas that I laid before you. I think we can say that a good example is perhaps the most important of all. The story is told of a child who was afraid in the middle of the night when there was a thunderstorm. And she was over in her bedroom crying. And the parents went over there to comfort the child. And she said, the father said, or the mother, whoever it was, said, well, you don't have anything to fear. Jesus is with you in the storm. Everything will be all right. And the child just with quivering lip responded, yes, I know. But I need someone with skin on. And see, that's how it is. We can have all these abstracts out there and we can lay all these things out before our children, but they need someone to show them. They need someone with skin on. God, through the inspired writings of the scripture, did not leave us without instruction of how to live, but the new covenant is based on how that Jesus came in the flesh and showed us how to live. He came with skin on. And I think we should do the same. We need to instruct, but we also need to exemplify. See, these abstracts, these things that we have in our heads become reality when we model and when we do, when we exemplify our teaching. So I just wish you God's blessing as you serve your families as parents, as your fathers and directing the affairs of your family, as your mothers, nurturing and teaching and training. And together, as you as couples relate together, I just wish you the grace and the blessing of God. Let's kneel for prayer.